The following is an ATS Mix exclusive interview.
Well, after being bone dry for such a long time, it certainly seems like miracles have not been ending for the ATS Mix team.
I tell you, it's been unbelievable last couple of weeks, John.
We have had ourselves what would be known in the business as heavy hitters.
Yeah, where's Barry Bonds when you need him, right?
And I would like to just add this disclaimer that any of our interviews that we do are 100% steroid-free.
That's right. And we don't care what the commies say.
That's right. We had the wonderful opportunity of being able to interview Stanton Friedman, the nuclear physicist who has done so many wonderful years of research in ufology. And we were just totally blown away. He's a Leo, just like you, Dave.
Yes, and can I tell him a little secret?
Oh, please.
Well, when Johnny and I do interviews, the only way that we can keep from really walking all over each other is we have this little communication device that we use to sometimes I get dry for thoughts, and Johnny will give me a couple of key things to do, which he did in this interview, and or vice versa. It's just something we just communicate with where the guest doesn't know what we're saying, and it's not to be secretive or, well, maybe we're above topsecret.com. Maybe it is being secretive. But the point, I don't know what the hell point was I going to make on this. I don't even have a clue anymore. I've forgotten what my point was.
Well, then let's just let everybody know that this interview...
My point is driving me crazy.
When it comes to you, you'll let everybody know, I'm
sure. I know what it was. Time out. I know exactly what it was. You said he's a Leo.
Yes.
And I said yes, but I don't know what they have to do with secret messages to each other.
Anyway, folks,
I have completely lost it on this. I have no idea.
As we have said so many times before... We really don't know a lot of times what we're getting into when we interview a guest, and we never script anything. We may do some research on the guests that we're covering to try to have the appropriate questions. And speaking of questions, we, of course, want to thank our fine members here at AboveTopSecret.com.
Oh, yeah.
We tried to ask as many questions as were posted, and we probably didn't get to all of them, and a lot of that has to be because Stanton, being the astute, intelligent man that he is, was answering those questions without your knowledge.
He was in stealth mode.
He was sharing that information with you, and so there was absolutely no point for us to then repeat it by asking your question again. So please, no offense, nothing negative. It's just the way the ball rolls. I think you folks are really going to enjoy this. In fact, at one point in time, Dave and I both were able to just really kick back and enjoy Stanton during this interview, because when Stanton gets on a roll, you don't want to butt in. You just want to let him go and hope that you can hold on to that coattail, and that's what we did.
Have you ever seen those bird feeders to where they're rigged to where if a squirrel gets on it, that it starts spinning around?
No,
have you ever seen
that?
Oh,
no.
Yeah, well, they have them here in Texas. It's basically this bird feeder, and then what they do is they fill it for the bird seed. Well, the squirrels come and try to eat it. So they've got this thing where it's motorized, and if a squirrel puts his weight on this little perch thing, which is obviously heavier than a bird, then the thing starts spinning around. Well, I saw a video earlier of this squirrel, and he's holding on with his little paws on the front of the little perch, and it's going around and round and round. This squirrel holds on for something like 2 minutes, and then all of a sudden it goes shwing. And that's the point of this is exactly how Johnny and I felt when we were talking to Stan, because, man, once he gets on a roll, you're hanging on for dear life.
I was wondering how on earth is he going to tie that in? Well, now
I
know.
Pretty good, though. Oh, was that pretty good or not? Was that a good analogy or not?
We'll leave it to our members to let us know, I'm sure, by you to you. Anyway, here it is, ladies and gentlemen, our interview with Stanton Friedman.
Stan the man!
Well, the ATS Mix is extremely honored to have the privilege of being able to have with us for this interview somebody I wanted to have on the show right from the conception of this program.
Oh, no question about it. And what's amazing is the response from the AboveTopSecret.com membership. Boy, they have just been chomping at the bits for us to talk to Stan.
Absolutely. So let's tell everybody who we're speaking about. It's Stanton T. Friedman, who received a B.S. and M.S. degree in physics from the University of Chicago in 1955 and 1956. He worked for 14 years as a nuclear physicist for such companies as General Electric, General Motors, Westinghouse, TRW, and many, many more. This was on advanced, highly classified projects as nuclear aircraft, fission and fusion rockets, and nuclear power plants for space. Since 1967, Stan has lectured on the topic of UFOs at more than 600 colleges and over 100 professional groups in 50 states and in numerous countries the world over. He has been nicknamed the Father of Roswell since Stan was one of the first to investigate the incident beginning in 1978 and has been investigating UFO cases since the mid-1950s. He has published more than 80 UFO papers and appeared on hundreds of radio and TV programs. And we would like to invite you to go to his website, which is at www.stantonfriedman.com. His latest book, which was released, I believe, in July, was Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. The ATS Mix is most honored to have with us Stanton Friedman. Hello, Stan.
Hi, from beautiful Fredericton, New Brunswick, four time zones ahead of you guys.
What's the weather like there?
It'll get down to zero tonight. We had 10 inches of snow yesterday. We're expecting more on Wednesday. So, yeah, it's a little cold here in Canada sometimes, but you can live with that. It's easy to handle.
You know, there's a rumor floating around that you are possibly working on a new book. Is that correct?
Yep, and it's only a rumor until I get it finished, I guess, but the title is Flying Saucers and Science, and I have a contract with the same publisher, New Page Books, as did Captured, because that one did so well. They're putting their eggs in my basket, or I'm putting mine in theirs, I guess, and this will be sort of my magnum opus. I've been lecturing for 40 years. I figured, over 40,000 questions. And
wow.
You can't include everything in a lecture, or I've written about 80 papers. You can't include everything in a paper. And I do a monthly column for the MUFON, Mutual UFO Network Journal, and for UFO Magazine. You can't get everything into one paper. So this book will cover all the important questions. You know, is there a cosmic Watergate? You're darn right there is. Is there overwhelming evidence that Earth's being visited by intelligently controlled extraterrestrial vehicles? Of course there is, and I'll put it all out there. I will deal with the SETI cultists. You know, you've heard of SETI.
We understand it's real high on your list, too.
Well, yeah, SETI is really known as the Silly Effort to Investigate, SETI, you know. And I'll deal also with some of the strange views of science fiction writers towards UFOs and where these things might come from and about Roswell and Majestic 12. We put it all in one big volume. It becomes a textbook for every class on flying saucers. And there are a couple, incidentally.
But, well, that sounds wonderful.
It's a heck of a lot of work, and it's the wrong season of the year because things are busy right now, but we'll get it done. Incidentally, my website does have the book Top Secret Magic about the Majestic 12 documents. It also has a number of videos and DVDs and my book Crash at Corona, the definitive study of the Roswell incident. Corona is a small town, much closer to the crash site than Roswell actually is.
Right.
Before I let Dave get into some of his questions, and by the way, we have a number of very intelligent members at AboveTopSecret.com that have also submitted questions for us to ask, but I have to ask this question. What on earth motivates a nuclear physicist to get into the ufology line?
Well, I started off slow, read a few books, discovered a report nobody was talking about, the biggest report ever done for the Air Force. Started lecturing to professional groups while I was working in industry, found that they were excited, intrigued, great crowds, And when the bottom fell out of the advanced nuclear and space systems business, might as well go full time. I like being my own boss, and I can't think of a more challenging scientific problem than, you know, how do you get here from there? Why the cover up? I bring to the table some very special background things. I work on advanced propulsion systems so that I can deal with the stupid comments that you can't get here from there from the ancient academics and fossilized physicists. You know, I worked under security for 14 years, so I can deal with the stupid comments that couldn't cover anything like this up. Of course you can. Many examples of other things that have been covered up. Because of all the lecturing and the questions and stuff, I am in a better position than most to deal with the why questions. You know, I present a lot of data in my lectures, 5 large-scale scientific studies, and I deal with cases that I've been involved in, and I prove that there's a cosmic Watergate and all that stuff. But the questions people really want answered, and it's easy to accept facts, but they want to know, well, how come? Why would aliens come here anyway? And, why would the government cover this up? And that sort of why questions, why don't they land on the White House lawn, you know, stuff like that, as if the President of the United States spoke for 6.5 billion Earthlings. He has trouble speaking for 300 million Americans.
You know? Yeah, much less extraterrestrials, right?
Yeah. And so the fourth thing I bring to the table is that I was a state championship debater in high school a long time ago in Linden, New Jersey. I enjoy being on the stage, and the bigger the crowd, the happier I am. I'm a Leo. Me and Peter Jennings both were born on July 29th, and I hate to admit it, but somebody else who was born on July 29th was another famous orator, Benito Mussolini.
Let me get
spellbinding speaker, you know. So I got a big mouth, and I like being on the stage, and so it's a good combination, in other words. And frankly, I like being my own boss.
Sure.
My programs don't get canceled anymore. I set a record for working on canceled government-sponsored research and development programs. You know, you work 3 years here, they cancel the program. You move halfway across the country, you work 3 years, they cancel the program. You do it again and a fourth time. And at some point, you say, the heck with it.
Well, Stan, you know, speaking of projects that are canceled, I was just wondering if you got involved in the Texas debacle, which was the Super Collider project.
Oh, no, no. I worked only in industry, none of this academic stuff. Well, you know, those who can do, those who can't teach, somebody once said to me, that's a nasty crack. But it was it illustrates one of the problems, though. When I was interviewed for the Peter Jennings mockumentary of February 24th, 2005. After we finished, it was a good interview. It took about an hour. They wound up using 20 seconds, I might add, and calling me a promoter twice, but never mentioning I was a scientist. You know, minor details left out. But anyway, when we finished the show and everything went well, the guy says, you know, Stan, don't you think that if these things were real, that half the academic scientists would in the country would be working on UFO-related projects? And I said, absolutely not. You want technology, you go to a Lockheed, you go to a Boeing, a General Motors, a General Electric, Westinghouse. You know, people don't have any understanding of how big some of the classified advanced programs are. When I was working on nuclear airplanes for GE in Cincinnati, just outside Cincinnati, back in the late 50s, in 1958, we were spending $100 million that year.
Wow.
Employed 3,500 people full-time, 1,100 of them engineers and scientists. I mean, a university big research group, you know, you got 20 professors and 40 grad students.
Right.
We had 3,500 people, and $100 million was, frankly, a lot of money in 1958. Now it's peanuts, you know.
Oh, yeah, chump change, yeah.
What I'm saying is that the academics seem to be ignorant and arrogant. How's that for a combination?
I love the ignorant and arrogant.
Well, I say this because I'm sort of sneaky. In my lecture, which is Flying Saucers Are Real, it's not about UFOs. It's about flying saucers, because all flying saucers are UFOs. Very few UFOs are flying saucers.
Right.
And I'm interested in flying saucers, not in UFOs. But I cover 5 large-scale scientific studies. I ask after each one. I show a slide, tell them what's in it, and so forth. And after each one, I ask, how many of you have read this? And if I'm lucky, I get 2% who've read any of them.
Mm-hmm.
And this right. tends to keep down the questions from the people who say, well, I'm sure one could come to other conclusions than you have. And I had one guy ask me that in technical group. I said, well, as I recall, you hadn't read any of these 5 studies, had you? Well, no. Well, that's the difference between us. I give you my conclusions. I give you my sources of data. You haven't read any of them. Whose opinion is worth more? He didn't say another thing, you know.
Funny how that works.
Really?
Yeah, and so I'm happy. I've done several debates because I get so sick of people thinking that, there's really nothing to this subject. I don't know. A lot of people probably saw me on the Larry King Show on July 13th that was repeated twice after that. Well, there was a nasty, noisy negativist sitting next to me, Dr. Michael Shermer.
Shermer, yeah.
And he was playing with little alien toys. I mean, this is the level of discourse on his part. Well, we did a debate for 3 hours on Coast to Coast Radio on August the 1st, and they took a vote, and I got 80% of the vote. And the reason was straightforward. He hadn't done any homework. No. I read 2 of his books. I could quote back what he said. He hadn't done anything. He didn't know anything. He hadn't looked at any of these studies. And, you know, I don't see the point in giving a free springboard, if you will, to somebody trying to push a viewpoint which has no basis.
Right.
Sure.
And so strongly inclined to deal with facts and data. That's what nuclear physicists are about. Even won a debate at Oxford University Debating Society, would you believe? Also, I took on Dr. Seth Shostak.
He's the
SETI Institute, and we kind of a strange story. We were both giving 3 lectures on the Queen Elizabeth II on its last westward cruise from England. We were polite to each other. I mean, the cruise takes a week. What are you going to do?
Yeah, you don't want to get thrown overboard, right?
That's right. And so this was in the wintertime, too, so you got to be careful. The water's awful cold down there in the North Atlantic. But I asked my questions there, and he didn't raise his hand for having read any of them. Well, about 6 months later, we did a 3-hour debate on Coast to Coast again. And this time the vote, they had a third option. It was a tie. So 57% said I won, 33% said he won, and 10% said I don't know who won. And so the reason I bring this up is these guys are so accustomed to spouting nonsense and getting away with it, the doctor has spoken. And I'm not just joking when I say that SETI stands for Silly Effort to Investigate. Think about it for a minute. The basic assumptions have no science background. They presume that there's somebody out there, because if there wasn't, there'd be no point in listening.
Or searching.
There's no to listen to. But they presume that we somehow are so smart, we can figure out what frequencies, what kind of equipment, and all that sort of thing.
Right.
Well, we've had radio for 100 years. The planet's 4.5 billion years old. The galaxy is someplace maybe 13 billion years old. And we, with our lousy background, short term, are going to figure out what they're doing? I mean, that's absurd. And why would it's funny. If you look as a function of time, well, how close do you think the nearest civilization is? About 5 or 10 years ago, they were saying, 20, 30, 40 light years.
Right.
Now they're saying hundreds of light years.
Right.
They haven't picked up any signals. And the Drake equation isn't science. How can it be a scientific equation if people plug in different numbers and they get someplace between 1 million and 1 billion civilizations in the galaxy?
There's a big difference, huh?
Yeah, it's like a slight range here we're talking about. And you know, if there's an equation, you ought to be able to plug numbers in. Well, do we have any data at all at the average lifespan of an advanced civilization? The answer is zero. We have none. We have one civilization that we know something about. That doesn't mean there haven't been past civilizations here that were advanced. But right. to generalize from, well, maybe we will last 500 years, maybe 1,000, maybe 10,000. And somehow that tells us how many civilizations in the galaxy last how long. Oh, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is.
And what we're really talking about here is job security for radio astronomers. And, you know, I'm not interested in providing job security for them. If you are interested, you know, SETI is supposedly a search for extraterrestrial intelligence. They're not. They're searching for signals that could right. be produced by something that could have been destroyed 500 years ago.
Right, exactly.
If you want to look for intelligence, you look at the enormous amount of evidence. They have none, you understand, that there's anybody out there sending signals that we can interpret. We have not one shred of evidence about that.
Right.
And they keep saying that there's no convincing evidence about UFOs. Well, they haven't looked at any of it. And there is an enormous amount of evidence, not only the five large-scale scientific studies, but over 4,000 physical trace cases from 70 countries. We have multiple witness radar visual sightings. We can prove the cosmic Watergate very easily with the blacked-out CIA documents and the whited-out NSA documents.
Right.
There's a lovely quote from an Air Force general, Carol Bolander. He was given the job after working on the lunar excursion module. And in late 69, in early 1969, the Condon Committee report had come out suggesting that Project Blue Book be closed because it really wasn't contributing much. And, right. and they were right.
Really? Yeah,
anyway, General Bolander was asked to review the situation and come up with a recommendation. So in October of 69, he put out a memo, not public, it was classified, but in it, he notes that reports of UFOs which could affect national security are made in accordance with Joint Army Navy Air Force Publication 146 or Air Force Manual 55-11 and are not part of the Blue Book system. And then to reiterate that, two paragraphs later, he says if Blue Book is closed, then the public won't have a place to report UFO sightings. However, as previously noted, reports which could affect national security will be investigated in accordance with the regulations established for that purpose. Hmm. Now, the public has never been told by the Air Force, oh, the good stuff didn't go to Blue Book. It went someplace else. Well, I located General Bolander. I doubt if he's alive now, but I located him, talked to him, very sharp guy. Good engineer, one of my kind of people, and it was clear he understood exactly what he was saying, that suppose a saucer goes down the runway at a SAC base, strategic air command.
I'd like to see that, because I used to be on the SAC base. I'd love to see that happen.
Well, you know, some of them have nuclear weapons stored there. Mm-hmm. So if a saucer goes down the runway at a SAC base where nuclear weapons are stored, that is very definitely a national security problem, wouldn't you say?
Sure.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, what I see standing in my backyard flying over, that's not a national security problem. But when they go down the runway at SAC bases, that's national security. Well, there's a new book out called Shoot Them Down by Frank Fascino Jr. I wrote the foreword and the epilogue, and he covers the events of the summer of 1952. And we discovered proof that military pilots were ordered to shoot UFOs down if they didn't land when instructed to do so. Now, you can think of a lot of doesn't that conjure up cartoons all over the place?
Yeah, it conjures up a lot of cartoons for me.
Well, we found that, and we had a general, an Air Force general, say we've scrambled interceptors more than 300 times.
Hmm.
And that's we can prove that, and he proves it in the book. We also found that just the New York Times alone, over 1951 to 56 period, they listed over 200 crashes of military aircraft, almost all in the United States.
Right.
Korean War kind of stuff. And using words like disappeared and disintegrated.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
And, I mean, 200 and a lot of planes, and three of the pilots had each flown more than 100 missions in Korea where the MiGs were trying to shoot them down.
Right.
You've got to be a good pilot to survive that, you know? You
sure, sure.
And they come back to the United States where there ain't no MiGs, last time I heard, and they crash. Doesn't
yeah.
that make you wonder just a little bit? I mean, three times like that?
Yeah,
wow.
So we have a totally wrong picture of what's been going on. The noisy negativists try to convince us nothing's been going on. There's a heck of a lot that's been going on. I haven't mentioned Roswell. We recovered wreckage and bodies in 1947.
Right.
And, you know, I've got papers on my website dealing with Roswell and dealing with the MJ-12 documents, which are viciously attacked by people who don't know what they're talking about.
Sure.
That's the nice thing about having been to 20 archives. I know something about documents. I wrote classified documents myself. And frankly, I get disturbed at listening to the armchair theorists. Oh, that document's got to be a fraud. Look, the date format doesn't follow the government style manual.
Right.
You go to the darn archives and you find, I found one file folder had seven different date formats. This is back in the 50s now, before, you know, this is before computers were such a big thing.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so it depended on who was typing the darn thing. You know, don't tell me what the rules are. Let's see what the practice was. So I get a kick, you know, somebody would spend me, if they pay me, I'd spend the full time in archives because it's fun. But one thing you learn pretty quick is there's still an awful lot of classified material out there that's old. The Eisenhower Library, archives, if you will, still has 300,000 pages of classified material, and he went out of office in 1961.
Wow.
I say that because I get people saying, well, all that stuff's automatically declassified after 10, 20, 30 years. Nonsense! It simply is not. And you go there, you find that out. You ask for stuff that's listed in a finder's guide, and you get something that shows a withdrawal sheet. This document is unavailable. You can request it. The typical response time for these mandatory classification reviews averages 2 years, sometimes as much as 6 years. And sometimes you
wow.
get it, and sometimes you don't.
Right.
I talk about this in Top Secret Magic, but, you know, I get so sick of people telling me, oh, that can't be right. The late Philip Klass, you remember him, Mr. Noisy Negativist himself.
Right.
He wrote four anti-UFO books. He was a senior avionics editor for Aviation Week and Space Technology. All sightings have prosaic explanations. Amazing that the Air Force couldn't find them. But anyway, he said, oh, this document has to be a fraud because the typeface is the large Pica type, but it's supposed to be the elite type because I got nine documents. He got them by mail. He's never been to the Eisenhower archives, and they all had elite type. And he challenged me to find any other genuine documents with the same size and style type. And he had a bunch of kickers. It's got to be signed and so forth. Anyway, I was going to the Eisenhower library, and I sent him 20 out of my files. I knew he wasn't going to accept most of them, but they were Pica type. I was going to the Eisenhower Library, so I came back. I sent him 14 and an invoice for $1,000. He offered me $100 each for every such genuine document, saying that perhaps I hadn't noticed that they were done in Pica type instead of elite type. Of course I'd noticed it. I'd been there. I looked. But so I sent him 14 and an invoice for $1,000. It's a shame he put a limit on it. I'd have been a rich man.
Oh, really?
And, he sent me a check for $1,000. Now, he paid off.
Oh, good. Well, good, good, good.
He told everybody about challenging me, but nobody about paying me. Don't bother. Remember, there are four rules for UFO debunkers. This goes for debunking anything, really.
Okay.
First is, don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up.
Yeah.
The second is, what the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. The third is, if you can't attack the data, attack the people. It's a heck of a
lot. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And do your research by proclamation. Investigation's too much trouble, and nobody will know the difference anyway. So with those four rules, you can get rid of any, quote, paranormal phenomena.
Right.
But that's not science. It's not journalism. It's bias and prejudice and ignorance and debunkery, deny. There must be a word that goes with being a
deny ignorance.
Well, okay. That's good.
Good. I'm glad you like that, because that's AboveTopSecret.com's policy. And one of our main slogans is deny ignorance, because people that just think it's just a status quo, they don't question anything anymore. You know, it's ridiculous.
I do.
Well, I know you do.
I get a kick out of it.
I love it when you question things, Dan.
Well, what I'd like you to do is, if you could, tell some folks about that might not know about the Betty and Barney Hill experience. Tell them a little bit about it and what they'll find in your book.
There was a book written in 1966 called The Interrupted Journey by John Fuller, which was a very good book about the case, but was incomplete, we now know. And there was a television movie that a lot of people saw called The UFO Incident on NBC, starring James Earl Jones.
That was great.
I was a consultant on that. Would you believe that Universal Studios got my name? I was living in Southern California at the time. Got my name from the United States Air Force.
Are you kidding me?
Wow.
No, I'm not. Which I thought was funny as can
be. That's hilarious.
The Betty and Barney Hill case was the first abduction case to be carefully investigated. It wasn't the first abduction case, but it set the tone for careful, detailed investigation. Now, they were an above-average couple. Betty was a social worker with the state of New Hampshire, supervising the welfare department. Barney worked for the post office. Barney was black, Betty was white, and that was a big deal in 1961 in New Hampshire, as you can imagine.
I'm sure.
There were still states, incidentally, where you couldn't have a mixed marriage. New Hampshire wasn't one of them, but I mean, I mention that only because, if you'll pardon the terrible pun, it colored some people's view of the story. Anyway, they spotted a UFO as they were driving home from Montreal to their home in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, on September 19th and 20th, 1961. Sort of followed along with them. It moved in a crazy fashion. It was big and round and had a double row of windows. They stopped the car twice, scared the heck out of them. Barney, through binoculars, saw a bunch of beings inside looking back at him. And they remember everything about the observation of the UFO. What they didn't know, and it was really strange, when they got home, it was 2 hours later than it should have been. I mean, it's late at night, no traffic in New Hampshire late at night. You know, they know
exactly
the time it took for gas and so forth. They reported it that next day. And then Betty got a book out of the library by Major Donald Kehoe, who had been head of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. And it said in the back, if you have a UFO sighting, please write us about it. They did. And a few weeks later, they got a six-hour interrogation from a NICAP investigator, an astronomer, as a matter of fact.
Right.
And it became kind of clear that there was some missing time here. It couldn't have taken them that long. Their watches stopped. Barney's shoes were scuffed. A lot of strange things.
Right.
Well, they went on. Betty had some peculiar dreams about supposedly being abducted by beings of some kind. Barney developed an ulcer, and the doctor worked on it. Didn't do him much good. Finally wound up with a psychiatrist who finally figured something is wrong here. Barney couldn't work anymore. The ulcer was so bad. He sends him to a psychiatrist named Dr. Benjamin Simon down in Boston. Now, he was a very special guy. He had developed very successful techniques for having people relive the get through post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Right.
And it was shell shock war veterans from World War II, basically. You know, your buddy's head gets blown off next to you. Sometimes that's a little hard to handle. And right. So Dr. Simon used medical hypnosis. This isn't parlor game stuff. To get people to relive with all the emotional intensity of the original experience and to work through it. And he actually ran a 3,000-bed VA hospital for people who had post-traumatic stress syndrome. They didn't call it that then, but we
right.
know now. And so the book, The Interrupted Journey, that I mentioned, leans heavy on Dr. Simon's work. He had final say on everything. And what came out under hypnosis, they were each hypnotized independently, and amnesia was induced after each session. This went on for 6 months, mind you. So they didn't know they couldn't talk to each other about what was going on in the session. Dr. Simon taped everything, finally brings them in together, and plays back the tapes, and they were astonished to find that they had each relived the same incredible experience of that craft having landed, of them being taken on board against their will by those beings that Barney had seen through the windows. They were treated as specimens.
Right.
Stick a needle here, scrape a little skin there, take a sample of hair, all that sort of thing. Put back out, totally wouldn't remember what happened, and didn't until this elaborate, sophisticated, expensive procedure was conducted. And what's new in this book is Kathleen Marden, the co-author who did most of the work, I took on the noisy negativists and I dealt with the very important star map work, but Kathy transcribed all the tapes. Betty had given her the audio tapes. And
now, this is Betty's niece, right?
Betty's niece. She heard about the sighting the next day because her mother was called by Betty's sister,
okay.
In other words. And she was 13 at the time, and she's the last 5 years of Betty's life lived very close to her. And so she transcribed all the tapes and did a comparative analysis to see whether indeed Barney's experience was just a reflection of Betty's dreams. She had made notes about these dreams, and they were not, even though that's the push that Dr. Simon had, was to... He believed they saw a UFO, all right, but he had problems with little guys on board a craft.
Right.
And so Kathy's analysis, and she's been trained in sociology and education, and she was the MUFON, Mutual UFO Network director of getting people to become investigators. There are tests to pass and so forth. She administered that program for 10 years. So this is somebody who knows a lot about UFOs, but was particularly intrigued with her aunt and uncle's case. And there's no question that in situations where they were both there, like in the car before the aliens took them on board, their accounts matched perfectly.
Wow.
And that was very important, and Barney's account does not match Betty's dream sequence. Now, the thing I got involved early on, I met them both way back in 1968. I'm an old-timer around here. I got the gray hairs to prove it.
I dye mine.
I don't. I earned every one of them, and I'm going to advertise them, you know. But one of the peculiar things that came out under hypnosis is they finished their examination with Betty. She asked the leader of this 11-being crew, "Where are you from? I know you're not from around here," the understatement of the month. He shows her what I can only describe as a three-dimensional star map, probably a hologram, 2 feet by 2 feet by 3 feet, a bunch of points of light that are supposedly stars, and different kinds of lines, heavy trade routes, light trade routes, occasional expeditions. And Betty's looking at this thing. "Well, where are you on the map?" she says. Wise guy alien says, "Do you know where you are on the map?" "No, I don't know anything about astronomy." "Well, how can I tell you where I'm from if you don't know where you're at?" End of discussion. Well, you can imagine Dr. Simon's reaction listening to this. Trade routes, expedition,
sure.
Star maps. Oh, my goodness. So he gives her, he checks to see if she can remember what the map looked like. She says yes. He gives her a post-hypnotic suggestion. If and only if she can remember it accurately, please draw it later on. And she draws it at home, and it's in the book, The Interrupted Journey. And you're left with a big question mark. Does this thing mean anything? After the book was published, a few years later, I get a call from Coral Lorenzen, head of the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization. And there's a woman named Marjorie Fish who's trying to make sense out of Betty's star map. And she was looking for a scientist that she could talk to. And Coral knew I was interested, knew that I'd met Betty and Barney, so she...
Right.
Gave me Marjorie's number. I called her. I was traveling a great deal lecturing. I visited her in Ohio, school teacher she was, and she sent me a lot of handwritten stuff, and I introduced her to J. Allen Hynek at the Adler Planetarium in Chicago and published the first article about her work. in Saga magazine, which a few people might remember if they're very
sure.
Saga.
Yeah. And I also instigated Astronomy magazine's coverage of Marjorie's work, and they did a splendid article, the editor Terrence Dickinson, and it got more reaction than anything they'd ever published before or since. And they published 11 letters over the next year, including from Carl Sagan and other astronomers. They put together a 32-page full-color booklet, and they sold 10,000 copies in no time flat, which is unheard of for this kind of thing.
Right,
sure.
And then Carl Sagan's lawyer, Carl and I were classmates for 3 years at the University of Chicago. So people won't mind if I call him Carl. We were in the same classes for three years.
Was he a practical joker?
No, he was not.
Did you guys ever pull any practical jokes stunts when you were in school together?
No, I don't remember any practical jokes.
You scientists don't have a sense of humor?
I didn't say he didn't have a sense of humor.
He's on this show, isn't he?
Yeah.
Hey, you got to have a sense of humor to do that.
That's right.
His lawyer threatened to sue Astronomy magazine because Carl's name, with a bunch of others, was on the front of this 32-page full-color booklet. And they made me an offer I couldn't refuse. So I wound up with 18,000 copies. And I'm out, unfortunately. It would be a great companion for Captured. But anyway, the important point about Marjorie's work, she was very objective, very careful. She's a member of Mensa. She built 26 different three-dimensional models, and she was able to finally identify all the stars in the pattern, about 16. And it turns out, quite remarkably, they are all sun-like stars. Not too old, not too new, not too hot, not too cold, not too close to another star, so it's hard to have sensible orbits, all this kind of thing.
Right.
And only 5% of the stars in the local neighborhood are sun-like, but all the sun-like stars in the three-dimensional volume of space that the map occupies are part of the map. So you got all the right kind and only the right kind. Chance of that being a coincidence. I love that word. You know,
right.
1 in 10,000 is about the numbers that people come up with. Now, some people say 1 in a million, but I'm a very conservative kind of guy. I only say 1 in 1,000.
We like that about you, Stan. You're conservative.
Yeah. Now, I should say this: the base stars, and there should be a flourish of trumpets. Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 reticuli, to which the normal response is, who cares? I never heard of those two dumb-sounding stars. That's the constellation of Reticulum, incidentally. You can't see it from here. You've got to go down the equator. These two stars, as it happens, and not known before Marjorie's work, are the closest to each other pair of sun-like stars in our entire local neighborhood. Now, our planet Earth goes around the star of the sun, sure. And the next star over is 4.5 light years away. Okay, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 reticuli, and reticulum means the net in Latin, those two stars are only 39.2 light years from here. It's just down the street, in other words. The galaxy is about 100,000.
It's in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Very much in the local neighborhood. But even more exciting, they're only an eighth of a light year apart. They're 35 times closer to each other than the sun is to the next star over. We're out in the boondocks.
Wow.
These guys got next door neighbors. And a bit of a head start on us. Those two stars are 1 billion years older than the sun. One would expect that Friedman's law holds that technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way.
Right.
So if they got 1 billion-year head start, how about even 1,000? They're going to have technology, which is magic to us.
Oh, of course.
M-A-G-I-C, not M-A-J-I-C, as in top secret. But it's a very exciting piece of work. The data that turns up wasn't known before the work was done, and I find it very persuasive. And that's discussed in the book Captured, along with my defending against the attacks of the noisy negativists. And there were a number of them. Every single one of Marjorie's critics misrepresented what she did.
Really?
And that's rather remarkable. You know, you don't mind sensible, healthy criticism. That includes Carl Sagan in his description of what she did. And so I find that rather intriguing. If that's the best you can do, guys, you've lost the argument.
Yeah, you've lost the war, too.
Yeah, the battle and the war, right on. So that case is a very important case. It's very exciting. And John Fuller, in the original book, only used some of the tape material, because as it turns out, when Kathleen Martin went over all the tapes, Dr. Simon sometimes asks the same question three or four times in different circumstances.
Right.
So Fuller, of course, only used one of those when he was making a narrative. But I've looked at his papers. They're at the Boston University Archives. And Dr. Simon had final say on everything. And boy, he gave Fuller a hard time.
Oh, I bet.
Probably made for a better book, but I don't know how John put up with it, you know. You can't say this, you can't say that, I'll get laughed out of the psychiatric society, you know, that sort of thing. So it's an exciting story. It was well done in the movie, well done in the first book.
Right.
And which became a bestseller in several countries, incidentally. Now, I don't know if that'll happen to Captured, but maybe so.
Well, we got to hope so anyway, you know, Stan.
Yeah.
You know, now
that
now that we consider you an intergalactic bud, you know.
Well, intergalactic is what I'm interested in.
See, I knew you were going to come back. I knew you were going to come back with some kind of scientific dialogue that was going to make Dave look silly. Dave Rabbit here again with the ATS Mix Show from AboveTopSecret.com. If you love politics and are tired of hearing and reading all that robotic crap that keeps churning out from the mainstream media, then come join me and thousands of people from around the world at AbovePolitics.com. They have political forums for everyone's taste, including U.S. politics, United Kingdom politics, Canadian politics, head-to-head political debates, politics of war. They have a general chit-chat and a freshman forum for you newbies and rookies to the political arena. There's also forums about Mideast conflict, socialism. They have a slugfest, liberalism, conservatism, moderate, and my personal favorite, military and security issues. So if you don't want to be another sheep, and want to be a unique thinker, AbovePolitics.com is for you. Part of the Above Network, LLC. Deny apathy. AbovePolitics.com.
This concludes part one of this episode.